This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. All right, so here we are. We're on this chunk of land, upper hemisphere. We call it the Western Hemisphere, depending on your perspective. It's bordered by oceans, three when you count Alaska, three oceans. And we call ourselves, sitting on this plot of land, Americans. And each of us has a pretty good idea what it means to be American. We might not all agree with each other, but we get it ourselves. And whether you take a progressive, inclusive view or the nationalist, exclusive view, we mostly agree that we are bound by a certain set of laws defined by borders, common currency, and, of course, a belief that the New York Yankees are the greatest team in the history of baseball. All right, there's some debate on the last one, but you get my point. We all know what a nation is, sometimes called a nation state, to distinguish it from ancient city states and other states like kingdoms or empires. And we've lived in one for so long that it's hard to imagine any other way of organizing ourselves. But in fact, the nation-state has faced enormous pressures in the age of globalization. First, the millions of stateless people in the world, refugees forced from their homes by violence and instability. And then the trend over the past several decades to reduce many state benefits like social services and market protections. Not to mention the unprecedented threats to national security posed not just by other nations, but by individuals acting outside the bounds of statecraft and diplomacy. So our question today is, what is the future of the nation state? Well, first I figure out we should find out how we got here. So I'm going to talk with Joseph Greco, who is a professor of political science at Duke University, specializes in international studies, and he joins us now. Joe Greco, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank. It's very good to be here. It's a great pleasure to be on your show.
It's nice to have you. So we kind of think, and I guess there's some debate about whether it's a nation state or a state, but we get the idea. These things bounded by these boundaries that we all agree on, France, England, Russia, the United States. And we kind of feel like 'twas ever thus, but really the nation state's just a few hundred years old, right?
Yes, indeed. Humans have lived in large-scale organized societies for roughly at least 5,000 years. This is true in the Near East. One can find similar arrangements in Africa, similar arrangements in China, for example, as well as in the Americas. The development of what we call the modern nation-state is perhaps different scholars have different ideas, but I think we can say that the process by which such nation states came into being began perhaps in the year roughly 1400, began to take form in the form of royal dynasties in the 17th century, and in some cases took on the more democratic form that we see today in places like the United Kingdom or the United States and elsewhere, France, in the 19th century. So it's a relatively recent form of political organization. That is to say, it's a territory in which there's a population and a government that has a relatively effective authority within the borders and the ability to reach agreements with foreign governments. The national character of some of these states has to do with the belief on the part of individuals and the reality, as you pointed out, of a certain set of common beliefs, common sense of history, common cultural interests such as sports, ability, I think very importantly, some commitment to an ability to communicate in a common language.
And this is interesting because, again, we take it for granted. But France, for instance, in 1789, the year of the French Revolution, we understand the French have a good, strong sense of what it means to be French. Not so in 1789. More than a dozen languages, fewer than half of the population spoke French. The Queen spoke Austrian. The idea of being French and having a nation was not on anybody's mind in 1789. It was a kingdom, and it was a kingdom ruled by dynasties that always had people from other nations sitting on the throne. That was the whole point of these marriages, right?
Well, I think there were some elements of a French consciousness that predated the 18th century. So, for example, the Hundred Years' War between the French and the English on both sides had reverberations, had effects in terms of creating a sense of Englishness on the one hand, Frenchness on the other. But there's no doubt that France was a very diverse, heterogeneous set of political groupings in a region we call France, with some centralized control right from Paris. That had been established in the 14th century and 15th century. But in the 100 years after the French Revolution, there was a much stronger effort on part of French central government, the government of Paris, to establish Parisian French, for example, as the sole type of national French that would be spoken. And there was actually some suppression of, for example, Breton, the speaking of Breton in the far western part of the country. There was some suppression of individuals in the far south in Provençal region.
So clearly there's an effort to make this happen. Something must be driving this change. We go back to the Treaty of Westphalia. You talked about the 1400s. This also coincides with the rise of colonialism. And I'm wondering if there's anything about the way in which nations had to arm themselves, defend themselves against other nations, and defend their supply lines as colonials that made their social and political organization.
Yes, have to change. As a very good political scientist in the 1970s wrote, the state made war, but in turn, war made the modern state. And I think that's true. Indeed, it helps explain how. If we look at the world in the year 1500, the world is divided into a number of regional empires, with one exception in Europe, where there is a potential empire, the Habsburg, but was successfully resisted by a number of European dynasties, including the Valois, the French kings. And this competition among the European states and war among the European states strengthened those states. For example, it led to the creation of effective tax systems, effective property rights systems, promotion of capitalist development, of market development. In turn, by roughly the year 1700, it meant that these countries, whether it be France or Britain, were in a position where they could, or the Netherlands could extend outward and begin to colonize the rest of the world. That then eventually reversed itself through decolonization, but left in its wake these forms we call states in the former colonial areas. This was true with the first in the United States, but then after World War II, it extended greatly, so that today we have 193 actual members of the UN plus two observers. So that's war played was not the only reason we see the emergence of a state system, but it played very prominent role in that process.
We're talking about the future of the state today on The State of Things. To do that, we're going to take a look backward and figure out how we got here. And for that, we're talking with Joseph Greco, who is a professor of political science at Duke University. So this is interesting also because the medieval warfare, those wars that were settled by the Treaty of Westphalia, that's recognized by many as sort of the beginning of the nation state, those wars were fought by aristocrats. And aristocrats, you know, had land as a basis of wealth. And that land was where you fed your horses and sent out your knights. Now you've got a different kind of warfare. To defend these supply lines, you need more people, more technology, more money. You've got to have a bigger tax base. So really, the dawn of capitalism and colonialism is really what's enforcing, in large part, not the only factor.
Yes, I agree with that. And just following it up on, I would say that your point that modern warfare changed. One of the changes was the shift from cavalry-based knights to foot soldiers using longbows and pikes in the case of Spain, but also in the case of Spain and Switzerland. This led to a certain democratization, a pressure for those individuals who were giving military service. They had to be paid, number one, which meant there had to be an effective taxation system. But number two, they could insist on having some ability. Many of them were part of the countryside, but also part of the cities. And they were able to argue that, well, the cities should have some voice in the governing of their countries. And this, of course, became very prominent as a feature of national life in Europe in the 19th century. And then this idea of democratic participation spread to the rest of the world.
And to what extent was that the sense of democratic participation fueled by the requirement that you help serve your country also become strengthen a sense of national identity, and how much of that is tethered to ethnic identity?
Yes, I think it's definitely a role. These become self-reinforcing phenomenon. For example, one requirement for modern warfare is that you have soldiers that are able to read maps. And this means that you have to educate a wider and wider range of the population. Together with industrialization, where you have more and more people brought together to work in factories and to develop a sense of political consciousness, this intersection between the need for national education, on the one hand, and the concentration of individuals in cities, together translated into pressure, for example, in the Great Reform Bill of Great Britain in the first third of the 19th century, to extend the vote away from the rotten boroughs where just a few landowners could actually elect a member of parliament, or thousands of individuals in a city did not have a similar representation. Well, this pressure for need for and also benefit in providing education plus the development of cities translated into pressure for democratic representation.
Because you've got to convince these people that this is a thing worth dying for.
Correct.
And
yes.
So there's something in it for you. And the average serf in 1300 is not going to die for the Duke.
And would not need to, because you could use knights. But by the 19th century into the 20th century, with large armies that had to operate in some manner as mobile individual units, where individual motivation was important initiative, you needed to have a broader range of citizens.
Joseph Greco, a professor of political science at Duke University, specializes in theories of international relations, international political economy, and international conflict. What a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It's great.
Our conversation on The Nation continues on The State of Things. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, talking about the nation state and its future. What is it? How did it come to be? And where is it going? Melissa Aronchik is a professor of media studies at Rutgers University and the author of Branding the Nation, Global Business of National Identity. Melissa, welcome to The State of Things.
Thank you so much for having me, Frank. It's good to be here.
Tell us a little about your work. You know, we've just been talking about the origins of the nation state having a lot to do with the pressures to defend colonial supply lines and how war had changed, warfare had changed. But the point is that this is an artificial construction that you have to get people to believe in. There's a bit of a sales job that goes on here and convincing you that you're French or American. And you've taken this the other way around. You've actually taken a look at how nations sell themselves to other folks to create a brand, right?
That's exactly right. The book is, I went and did about 100 interviews with all kinds of people, branding consultants, foreign affairs representatives, diplomats, investment promotion agencies, to find out about this new phenomenon called nation branding, whereby governments actually hire branding consultants and marketing folks to help them create an image to sell for all kinds of reasons, for tourism purposes, to attract foreign investment, to attract perhaps the Olympics, all kinds of reasons.
Well, this is this experience was fueled by questions you had in Montreal, right?
That's right. When I lived in Montreal, I worked at an advertising agency. And one of our clients was the Quebec Tourism Board. Actually, we also had the Montreal Tourism Board, so we did a lot of work for tourism on behalf of Quebec. And I was in charge of creating an ad campaign to basically sell Quebec to American tourists. We were trying to encourage Americans to come up and spend their dollars in Quebec. And in many ways, that campaign was a very typical ad campaign. We had TV ads and radio and print and direct mail, stuff like that. But there were a couple of strange instructions that the Quebec Tourism Board gave us at the ad agency before we could create these ads. There's a standard set of ads that you make for tourism where you show things like nightlife, shopping, skyline, and of course in Quebec you always have to show things like people in t-shirts to convince Americans that actually we do have summer. So people aren't too nervous.
Yeah.
But the strange instructions they gave us were that we could not use the word Canada in any of the advertising. Not only that, but when we referred to Quebec, we could not refer to it as a province, but we were asked to refer to it as a nation. And that just, I was just absolutely floored by that when it happened. It had really never occurred to me until then that advertising could be used for political purposes. Maybe I should give a one-minute backstory here for your listeners who don't know too much about Quebec politics.
Yeah.
In Quebec, French is the primary language, and while many people in the rest of Canada speak French, English is really the dominant language elsewhere.
Yeah.
And because of the language and because of Quebec's sense of itself as having a distinct culture and a distinct identity, they have long wanted to be recognized as a separate, distinct society in Canada.
And came very close to separation not
long
ago.
That's right, more than once, twice, in fact, two referenda we've had, absolutely.
So fiercely nationalistic, proud of a culture and wanting to distinguish it, and as you say, French is the first language spoken there. And so these there was another instruction, I think, about the maple leaf that was also part of
Yeah, that's a funny one. Again, as you may know, the Canadian flag has a red maple leaf on it, a symbol of Canadian identity. So not only could we not use the Canadian flag, in fact, there was one image of all kinds of world flags in this downtown part of Montreal, Old Montreal, and we had to airbrush out the Canadian flag and put in the Quebec provincial flag instead. But even in fall foliage scenes, we had to airbrush out the red maple leaves from the fall foliage. So this was taken very seriously by the Quebec Tourism Board.
And replace it with a croissant, I think. Wait, so here's my question, though. Why do that? Because you're talking about the nightlife, the wine, the big buildings. It's always warm in Quebec. Really, believe us, trust me. What is it about? Why national identity? Why would anybody want to sell the national values of a place for people looking for a hot recreation spot?
Oh, that's a great question. And the answer is that people really do want to have an authentic experience when they go to a country. People care about the values that a country has now, increasingly so, I think. And not just for tourism, but also for investment. Whether you're a professional worker looking for somewhere to live or somewhere to relocate, you want to feel like the values of the country you go to parallel yours. If you're an international student, the same thing. You want to have an experience in another country where you feel like you're excited to be exposed to what that country has to offer. So, I mean, and of course, for consumer reasons, national identity really sells.
That's fascinating. That is part of that national experience, and therefore that's the exotic part. So tell me what it is. And you said that with Poland, for instance, had a particular challenge trying to throw off its perceptions and connections with the Soviet Empire.
That's right. Poland was a really interesting case. I first went to London when I started doing the interviews for this book, and I was trying to interview nation branding consultants. And one of the nation branding consultants I met with had Poland as a client. And he told me all about them, and he said, oh, they're so argumentative, they're so difficult. These people are, you know, and of course he's sort of saying, this is their national identity, they're a difficult people. And so it was very...
hard to sell that, isn't it? Yeah,
that's right. And he gave me what is called in the business a brand book, which is essentially a report that a brand consultancy will put together that describes the work they've done for that product or country, as the case may be. So I took that brand book and I saw the names of all the people that they had interviewed for their brand Poland project. And then I went to Poland and re-interviewed all of those people to get a sense of what actually happened with the branding project. So this was way back in 2003. It was on the eve of Poland's accession to the European Union. And I should say a lot of these nation branding projects did originate with the European Union. As new member countries tried to join, they got the sense that they needed to revamp their identities to be more Western, more European than Eastern European.
That's fascinating. And so all of this suggests how self-conscious branding is, the idea of nationalism. At the very least, it is a construction. It's something we make up in our minds. Perhaps it evolved somewhat organically in previous centuries now. And it's almost, it seems to me, through the looking glass, whereas you have politicians in those countries trying to understand and intuit, you know, some geniuses in getting at these sensitivities and the resentments about who these people think they are, right? Some sense of understanding our national identity, and then using that to get elected. And you're saying this is the other way around. We actually want to change some of what it is we think about ourselves in order to convince other people we're not what you thought we were.
Well, I think it works both ways. I mean, yes, you have politicians trying to get elected by using or promoting certain kinds of national values. But you also have all of the people in that country who have a sense of what that country stands for. And then you have the entire international community who may well have a different sense. And one of the things this project really taught me is just how important the international perception of national identity is. In other words, I think we care a lot about what other countries think of us, and we actually use those ideas to construct our identity.
Oh, so you think part of national identity does come, I suppose, in a more modern age, in the 20th, 21st century, when we're connected with how other people think, that kind of reflection and echo could influence our own sense of our own identity?
Absolutely. Actually, I don't even see it as a modern thing, though, of course, with the internet and so on. You can find out anything about any country in a moment. But I also think that for a long time in international relations, foreign affairs, there was always a sense of wanting to define yourself in relation to or even in opposition to other countries.
That's fascinating. Well, what about the United States? We talked about Poland. We talked a little bit about Montreal and Quebec. But yeah. The United States, what's the brand here?
That's the $64,000 question. The United States, as someone who grew up outside the United States, one of the things that struck me most when I first came to the U.S., of course, is the power of the Constitution, the way the Constitution gets evoked in daily conversations about all kinds of things. So I think that many people hold very dear the values of the Constitution and see those as foundational to national identity in the U.S. Of course, you know, a lot of people, especially these days, like to talk about how different governments, you know, whoever's in the White House at a given moment, projects values that are seen as quintessentially American. But as we've seen, that comes and goes with the government in power. So I think when people are talking about national identity, they like to think about values or beliefs or a sense of loyalty that goes beyond whatever's happening in Capitol Hill at any given moment.
Fascinating stuff. Melissa, thank you for talking with us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
Melissa Aronchik is a professor of media studies at Rutgers University and the author of Branding the Nation, The Global Business of National Identity. Well, nations do promote themselves and are self-conscious about their promotion. And then there are those organic, perhaps subconscious ideas about ourselves and nations. And then, of course, the question is, what do nations do? Are all of these branding efforts futile in the modern age, as some of the prerogatives of the nation have been lost owing to global pressures? And other pressures that are now we face, a refugee crisis worldwide, cryptocurrency taking away some of the authorities of governments. Our next guest argues the nation state is on its way out. Rana Dasgupta is a writer and the author of the recent Guardian piece, The Demise of the Nation State, and his upcoming book is called After Nations. Rana, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you for having me.
What got you thinking so deeply about the fate of the nation?
I think I've lived in a number of nations, and I've lived, for instance, a substantial amount of time in India. I grew up in the UK, and I've lived quite a long time in the US. And all of them have very different relationships to this idea of the nation. And I began to see in all of these places, for different reasons, the beginnings of a certain kind of decline of an older aura that the nation had. And I think what I want to argue is that not necessarily that the nation is on its way out, but definitely that the nation is beginning to fail to deliver some of what people have traditionally expected from it in this global era. The nation is outflanked by a lot of the processes of globalization.
Let's talk about we'll talk about some of them. What's going on, do you think?
Well, money is a big thing. As we heard earlier in the show, taxation has been a huge part of the definition of the nation state in some cases for 1,000 years. It's taxation that has really driven the sense of a nation, the idea of redistribution, the idea of a community formed through a financial contract. And the fact that the nation is having more and more difficulty, A, taxing monies, because we now have this vast and very significant offshore system of money, and B, redistributing money in a meaningful way, begins to give people a sense that governments can no longer do what they're appointed to do. When you have, for instance, in the U.S. over the last 40 years, presidents of very different styles and beliefs, essentially having no impact on the rising graph of inequality, you begin to doubt whether there is really any authority of the presidency over those kinds of things. And the idea that there is no authority, that politics doesn't do anything, that we can vote people in, but they actually have no influence over things. That leads to a very deep sense of disillusionment in the population.
It's more than just a kind of impotence. Hey, we elected you. How come you're not doing something? They bragged about it. You had Reagan on the one hand saying government isn't the solution, government is the problem. At the same time, Thatcher is saying there is no society. And they got elected by wide margins. In other words, people were saying, we're tired of government, get rid of it. And by golly, they did. They began to take out all of those things that government had traditionally supplied.
Yes, I think what we've seen over the last 40 years, beginning, of course, with Thatcher and Reagan, is a very, very substantial revolution led by political, financial, and corporate elites, which has basically succeeded in what it set out to do, which was to reestablish the supremacy of capital over states. It has succeeded so extraordinarily that states have been massively diminished in their status in the world. They've lost not only actual power, but also symbolic power, which is one of the reasons why we're seeing such kind of hysterical reactions in so many countries. In Western countries particularly, the idea that the state can drive the national destiny, the idea that politics has real influence over life and can form a society in the image of voters' desires, that idea has been extremely important. And when people start to feel that the state can't do these things, it's almost like a kind of a loss of faith. It's almost like a religious shock.
And
I think that everything that you were talking about with starting in the 80s, we've now got to a situation where there's so much autonomy to technology and finance that the old institutions of politics are beginning to look very outmoded indeed.
We're talking about the future of the nation state today on The State of Things. Talking to Rana Dasgupta, a writer and the author of a piece in The Guardian called The Demise of the Nation State. His upcoming book is called After Nations. Well, it seems to me that there's a kind of at least a twin motors of propelling all of this. On the one hand, you have the boast by government officials, initially conservatives who said government, we have to take government out. We have to stop propping up, take out government subsidies, take out any kind of nationalized industries and privatize, right? And scrutiny of our any kind of oversight on financial markets. Let them be, right? So all of this kind of pulling out the props. At the same time, technology, as you suggest, is becoming more autonomous. In other words, I'm not even sure we know how to control the algorithms that are now driving the stock market. So it seems to be like you've got these twin motors which are propelling this demise at a higher velocity than we might expect.
Yes. The system that has been built over the last 40 years is a twin system of finance and technology, and giving these areas more and more autonomy has been paradoxically one of the main strategies of lots of rich governments. Stripping themselves down and giving away power has been a very determined strategy, and now we're facing the consequences. We know that it would be impossible for the United States or any other rich country to impose 80 or 90% income tax rates as existed in the 50s and 60s. And that's just one demonstration of the ways in which the idea that a government is actually autonomous,
right,
and could do the things that it wants to do is clearly not the case. Governments are in the situation, and your last guest was referring to this to some extent, the governments are in the situation of being clients to international finance. And if they don't play the game, if they don't reorder their internal systems in order to be attractive to international finance, they will essentially drop out of the global economy. And I think we're all aware of this. And I think one of the reasons why there is so much gathering anxiety about foreign influence over our institutions, our politicians, and that's not just a U.S. phenomenon, it's happening in many places in the world, is because people are clearly aware that no longer is politics a national project at all. It is being determined by lots of factors that have nothing to do with people in this country.
Well, that's the other paradox, isn't it? The very constituents, the political constituents that had elected Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan to strip government of its authority are now, there's a backlash among with that constituency toward a greater ultranationalism that works against the principles of global capitalism. More protectionism,
yes,
Brexit.
Yes. So I think one of the things that's going on with people like Trump, and there are many other figures like him cropping up around the world, Viktor Orban in Hungary, this sort of ultra-nationalism is becoming more important as a kind of political platform everywhere. I think one of the things, reasons this is happening is precisely to substitute for these kind of disappearing powers. It's not a sign of any kind of health in any of these countries. It is a sign that that political leadership itself is in a state of crisis. So you can distract people from the fact that you essentially have nothing to offer them in terms of real material things by grandiose gestures. I'll put up a wall, or I'll kick out foreigners. Political leaders still control some things. They control borders. They control security. They can put people in jail. They can ramp up the police and things like this. They do actually control these things.
Rana, I'm going to take a break. I'm going to take a break here. I'm going to have to, and then I'm going to come right back. Rana Dasgupta is a writer. His upcoming book, After Nations, we will talk about the future of the nation state in a moment with Rana. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Today talking about the nation state. We live in one. We call it the United States. But what is its future? Still with me is a guest who argues the nation state is under great stress. Rana Dasgupta is a writer and the author of a recent piece in The Guardian called The Demise of the Nation State. His upcoming book is called After Nations. Before the break, you were talking about the fact that this rise in ultra-nationalism, not only in the United States but elsewhere, is a symptom of the stress and the pressures that the nation state is under. Another symptom, I suppose, is the number of civil wars active now in the world, and the number of refugees, people without states, without passports, effectively, who have to be resettled. I mean, what part is that playing in all of this, Rana?
Yes, we've been talking mainly about the rich world so far, and I think the spiritual crisis of the rich world as it sees these structures which are extremely fundamental to the way it's existed for a few centuries is a very important historical fact and needs to be taken very seriously. But yes, as you say, there are countries who are in a far greater state of turmoil, objectively speaking, than the rich countries of the world. Some of them are in our headlines every day. Syria is the most obvious example. Yemen. And some of them are almost never in our headlines because they have very little geostrategic significance, places like the Central African Republic, places like Chad. These are places that have progressively broken apart over the last decade or two. And this is part of a separate process which doesn't necessarily intersect with what we're talking about in the rich world. The major cause of this is the withdrawal of the superpowers from a lot of these places after the end of the Cold War. The 25 or 30 years period during which a lot of countries in the Middle East and Africa, which is the main zone of crisis I'm talking about, became independent from the European empires, was a period when they became of enormous importance to the superpowers as client states during the Cold War, and the superpowers poured in a lot of money and arms essentially to prop up dictators and make sure that those dictators had very little internal opposition so that they could rely on these people to be allies for them in that global conflict. That was a process that was disastrous for a lot of populations in those places because it exposed them to decades of brutality and oppression. But it did mean that the nation states themselves held together. And that was not obvious at all, because when they were carved out of empires, as we all know, many of those borders were completely arbitrary.
Right.
Many natural ethnic and religious communities were split between countries. There was no history of any kind of political community between the ones who were actually left within borders.
Without those strongmen imposed by and supported by the superpowers doing their bidding and protecting their supply lines for their rich clients, obviously those ethnic tensions then resurfaced. And again, now they're within artificial borders, so they didn't even have the means for solving them by traditional means.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So we've seen many countries break up under civil wars, national governments losing their authority over the territory of the state. In some cases, like Libya, several rival governments operating from different locations inside and outside the country. And we can look at the world map and think that, you know, Libya is a thing and it will have to endure and it will have to come back together in some ways. And there's lots of international negotiations going on about how that might happen. But if we remember the levels of power that were required to establish these things in the first place, if we think back to the European empires, if we think back to the power of the U.S. and the Soviet Union in the 60s and 70s, there is no comparable power right now, either militarily or financially, work.
Well, so what's the future? Do you think the state itself, as a form, is something that is maintained? Does it fix itself, or are we headed for some new form of social and political organization?
The future, I think, if the future, if we do nothing, is quite bad. I think we'll see many more countries in Africa and the Middle East going through these kinds of problems, because over the last few decades, those ethnic tensions have been stoked by those dictators. They are not necessarily ancient hatreds. They're quite new hatreds that are very raw right now. The rich world is going to continue seeing these things decline. So I think what I propose in my article and in my book is that we start thinking about what we can do about these things. And I think it's very clear that whatever scenario we imagine, the idea of an archipelago of national governments that looks after their own territory to a greater or lesser amount of success cannot be the only way that we try to manage these things. We need smaller and larger infrastructure to manage regional identities and spaces. And particularly, we need larger infrastructure if we are ever going to get a handle on global finance and give people a sense again that the wealth of the world can be rechanneled for public ends.
Accountability infrastructure. Rana, I want you to stay with us for just a minute, because we've been talking about the social, the economic, the military pressures on the nation state, but we've not talked as much about technology and its impact. But through tools like cryptocurrency and the dark web, some people have found ways to sidestep the controls of the nation state altogether. Jacob Siegel is a writer who recently profiled one of these people in a piece published in the magazine The Baffler. The piece is called Send Anarchist Guns and Money. Jacob Siegel, welcome to the State of Things.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about this and talk about cryptocurrency, for instance, because one of the things a state does, one of the monopolies a state holds, it holds a monopoly on violence and it holds a monopoly on currency and its regulation and manufacture. Cryptocurrency takes that power away from governments. Tell us what it is first and give us a rough sense of what I'm talking about here, cryptocurrency.
Sure. So certainly the intention of cryptocurrency is to take those powers away from the government, and it works fundamentally on an architecture, a technology that's referred to as the blockchain. And the blockchain is basically just an ever-growing digital record of every currency exchange and transaction that occurs with the different digital currencies. So Bitcoin is the the most well-known, but there are other cryptocurrencies. And they're traded using this technology called the blockchain, which is supposed to eliminate the need for any intermediaries. You don't need a bank. Everybody holds their own store of currency on their computer, and all these transactions are recorded in this ever-growing digital ledger that's referred to as the blockchain, and it's somewhere between a currency and a property at this point. It's hard to regulate, and it's very hard to tax.
Hard to regulate, hard to tax, and you don't mint it by a government process. So now you're stripping governments of one of their primary functions. In your piece, you profile a man who is known to many as a crypto anarchist. He's got other epithets, Cody Wilson. So tell us about him.
Yeah, so Cody Wilson is best known as the 3D guns guy. With his company Defense Distributed, he came up with this idea that he referred to as the Wiki Weapon. And basically what the Wiki Weapon was a way of putting the ability to manufacture firearms in people's homes. It was like DIY gun manufacturing. And it both, in its original form, relied on this new technology, new commercial applications of the technology of 3D printing. And it also relied on a kind of WikiLeaks open source sharing format where the designs for these guns could be distributed online. So the original idea was you would get a 3D printer, you'd be able to download these gun designs, and anybody could then print their own gun at home. Now, Wilson and his company, Defense Distributed, ended up running into legal problems, got embroiled in a battle with the State Department over the legality of the gun designs, actually. It was the digital files, not the 3D printers, that got them in trouble. And because of that, they sort of pivoted, and the company went towards, instead of 3D printing with these digital files, they went towards more conventional home gun kits. But Wilson is also involved in cryptocurrencies and generally is sort of involved in these various different spheres of the crypto anarchist movement, as it's referred to.
Well, talk about that movement and his ideology, because if we think about threats to national security, we often think about other nations and what they might be doing and planning. But now there's a whole body of individuals who are not tethered to a state, and Cody Wilson is one of them. Talk about his ideology and his ultimate dream.
Sure. So the ideology he's closest to, and he's sort of a guy who dabbles in many different ideologies. It's part of what makes him interesting is he can sound left-wing one moment. He's railing against capitalism. And in the next moment, he's praising the alt-right, and he sounds very right-wing. What runs through these different strains of his ideology is, first of all, a hard anti-statism, and also a kind of conservative or reactionary critique of modernity itself. But the ideology he's closest to is called crypto-anarchism. And the crypto there refers to crypto keys, which are ways of encoding information, and it's what Bitcoin and the various cryptocurrencies are based on. And the anarchy is a form of the politics of anarchism. It's an anti-statist movement. Really, it was originally the work of people in the technology field, sort of early Silicon Valley pioneers, including at one point Julian Assange of WikiLeaks, who was sort of involved in this movement. And it was people trying to articulate ways that emerging technology, specifically around cryptography, could make the state obsolete, how to break the monopoly of state power by using these technologies around cryptography that were supposedly or theoretically at least impossible for the state to regulate or interfere with.
How difficult is it for the state to interfere or regulate some of these things?
It's difficult enough that cryptography itself is heavily regulated by the state, and the original what's called PGP, which many people use now, Pretty Good Protocol, which is basically just a form of encoding information on your computer, originally was listed on a basically banned arms list, regulated arms list. So cryptography was listed essentially as a munition as far as the government was concerned in terms of an individual's right to distribute it. So the government recognized this as a threat fairly early on. It hasn't always acted consistently on that understanding, but the understanding was there from the beginning, and there were attempts at prosecuting early developers of cryptologic applications using what were basically laws and regulations that had originally been designed to control arms sales.
We're talking about the future of the nation state today on The State of Things. Talking to Jacob Siegel, who is an author of a recent piece in The Baffler called Send Anarchists, Guns, and Money. I'm tempted to ask, how big is this movement? But maybe that's not a relevant question anymore. Does it take a lot of people who think this way and have the technological savvy to begin to really unravel the system?
Certainly they hope it doesn't. I think that, you know, just working off of their internal logic, it wouldn't, because the... First of all, it's sort of a vanguardist movement. It's deliberately not a populist movement. They're not looking to get broad support. It's fundamentally elitist and hierarchical. But also the idea is that it's the technology that's the real agent of political change. So you don't need to get broad support. You just need to disseminate these technologies and they'll do the work. And that's why there's a sort of running joke in these crypto-anarchist circles that as governments adopt cryptocurrencies and other other forms of cryptography from them, that the governments are basically sealing their own demise by doing this. They don't understand it, but that the technology itself is what will undo state power.
So once again, selling them the rope that they'll use to hang themselves, I guess.
Precisely. Yeah.
Well, and to what extent, go ahead, because we talked about with Rana Dasgupta the same thing, this unraveling of state power and state authority, the functions of government, right, to provide for the common good. When that was done deliberately in order to play the game of global capitalism, you simply played into the hands of people who are more quickly unraveling the state. And we're seeing the same thing in the technological sphere.
Yeah, that's right. I was just going to point out that, you know, the big question now is, do these technologies get securitized, which is an ongoing thing, and we don't quite know yet.
Securitized, so you're talking about get financing?
Do they get regulated in the way that stocks are? Are governments able to basically absorb the technologies and then exert power over them? And are financial institutions able to do the same? Are they able to convert them into securities, essentially, which is what they'd like to do? Now, the crypto-anarchist hope is that the technology itself prevents that from happening. And like I said, is a sort of, you know, a bomb with a time delay inside of the system. But it remains to be seen. And there certainly are scenarios where states, in China, for instance, there's some evidence of this. States can actually use these technologies to consolidate and centralize power.
Wow. Great stuff. Jacob Siegel is a writer who recently published a piece in the magazine The Baffler. The piece is called Sent Anarchist Guns and Money. And Rana Dasgupta is a writer and author of a recent Guardian piece, The Demise of the Nation State. His upcoming book is After Nations. Jacob and Rana, thank you both for being on the program.
Thanks for having me.
You can find links to their work and other things we talked about today at our website, stateofthings.org, a program produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.